Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Joan Maloof, PhD. She works to educate others regarding the extent and condition of our forests and to encourage their preservation. She founded an organization with the goal of creating a network of protected forests across the U.S. That organization, the Old Growth Forest Network, now has thousands of supporters in over 185 forests in 32 states. www.oldgrowthforest.net. Oldgrowthforest.net. Is a professor emeritus at Salisbury University, where she taught biological sciences and environmental studies. She's the author of numerous research articles and 5 books. Her most recent book is Nature's Temples, A Natural History of Old Growth Forests. First off, thank you for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Good to be here.
Would you rather start by talking about the new book, or would you rather start by talking about the Old Growth Forest Network, or would you rather start by talking about old growth forests themselves?
All these choices. I think I would like to start by talking about the new book, if that's okay.
That's great.
So I am a forest activist, and I'm a biologist, and I speak out for the forests, and I see forests being cut that shouldn't be cut. And often there are people who want to save forests in their community from being cut, and they're looking for scientific evidence to present as to why those forests should not be cut. But that scientific evidence was all spread throughout the journals. In many of them, you would have to be associated with a university to even have access to the journals. You would have to know where to look. You would have to have the patience to read these journal articles. So with the new book, Nature's Temples, that was really my impetus to do that work for those people that are trying to save forests all across the country, and to bring that scientific information all together in one spot in a readable place. So what I did was, any study that was out there that compared older unlogged forests to younger, we'll call them managed forests, what did the scientists find? Now, there were scientists studying all kinds of different organisms, right? Some of the scientists were comparing moss species in older and younger forests, some of them salamanders, some of them snails, some of them wildflowers, some of them fungi. And in all of these papers, what I did is organize this chapter by chapter. So there's a chapter for moss, which shows that the scientific papers that compared the older forest to the younger forest found more moss species and rare moss species in the old uncut forests. So we can go on with every topic that I looked at. So for instance, snails, there was a master's degree student in Kentucky, and he was comparing snails in older unlogged forests to snails in these younger managed forests. And he was finding many more species and many more kinds of snails in the old unlogged forest than in the young managed forest. And there were some species only found in the unmanaged forest. And this goes on for all kinds of organisms, you know, for snails and beetles and so on. But what this means is that when we go into one of these older forests to so-called manage it, to cut it, what we're doing is making many of those species extinct, from the moss to the snails to the salamanders to the fungi and so on. As I said, I was writing this book for those activists that needed that information in a more easily accessible form. And even as I was writing it, I knew this is not going to be a bestseller, because there's just not that many people out there speaking for the forest and using the scientific information. But it really didn't matter to me whether it was going to sell a lot of copies or not. What mattered to me was that this information would all be in one spot in a usable form. I'm very happy that a publisher also believed in this book. And the first publisher who printed it was in 2016, and it was Timber Press. And Timber Press kept it in print for a number of years. And then at some point, like the popular presses do, they thin out their offerings. And all of a sudden, I heard that Nature's Temples wasn't going to be in print anymore. And that shocked me. I'd never had that happen to a book. I don't know if it's happened with a book of yours or not before. Has that happened to you, Derek?
Where they say they're not going to print it anymore?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I really wanted to keep this in print and make it useful. So I approached Princeton University Press that I was working on another project for Tree. That was my book, Treepedia. And I said, well, I'm doing Treepedia. I would really love to have Nature's Temples stay in print. And they said that we would love to do that if you would update it and expand it and add some chapters. And so I agreed, of course. And so I'm very happy that that revised and expanded Nature's Temples is available for pre-sale right now, and it's going to be released April 4th. It'll remain useful to all those forest activists out there.
So I'm going to do something really unfair now, which is to do sort of a pop quiz. And the reason I'm going to do this is because I did it once before, and it turned out delightfully. I was interviewing somebody about how fires help Western forests. He made the claim that it helps most native species who evolved in these forests, which of course makes sense if they evolved in a forest that has fire. And so just out of nowhere, I said, okay, great. Tell me how forest fires help salamanders. And I threw out a specific, you know, sort of class of creature. And he said, well, funny you ask that, because just last weekend I was on a survey trip about salamanders in a forest that had fire. And it ends up that, of course, because salamanders eat creatures who eat the detritus, you know, that forest fires create habitat for, create food for the salamanders. And it ends up that it increases even salamander populations. Mm-hmm. So I want to throw a couple groups of animals or of beings at you, and you tell me how they're better off in old growth forests. How about small fish?
Small fish benefit from old growth forests because the trees in an old growth forest that will occasionally fall across a stream create structure, right? And anytime you have structure in a stream, that means structure means some places the water is going faster and sometimes it's going slower and sometimes it's going under and sometimes it's going over. That structure creates multiple habitats. So that organisms that need slow water can find slow water, and organisms that need fast water can find fast water. And it's not just like throwing a twig in the water that's going to decompose right away. These larger trees that are big create long-standing structure. And they also, as a carbon-based organism, the trees, they're going to provide food source for microorganisms such as amoeba or algae that are going to live on that coarse woody debris in the stream that are going to be the food base for the small fish. So the old growth forests even benefit the fish. And that's one of the chapters that I added in this revised and expanded edition, was a chapter about forests and water and how they affect the things not only that live in the water, like in the streams, but how the forests can affect the atmospheric water. So there's a lot of tie in there.
Tell me more about the atmospheric water.
Well, this is a very interesting cutting edge area. So we all know that trees transpires. They take water up through their roots. It goes up through their trunk. It goes out the pores in the leaves. So 90% of the water that a tree takes up through its tree roots actually ends up transpiring out of the leaves. But when it evaporates out of the leaves, that evaporation takes energy. So it's pulling a little bit of energy out of the atmosphere. And there are a lot of people that believe that pulling that energy out actually will cool the atmosphere. So this evapotranspiration is critical for keeping our global warming in check or our climate change in check. And also that water that does evaporate out becomes the rain in the next place. So if, and the larger and older the trees are, the more evapotranspiration you're going to have in a particular acre. So if you cut that acre of trees down, you're not going to have any evapotranspiration. If you have very young little trees there, you'll have a little bit of evapotranspiration. So for the old growth forest, lots of evapotranspiration, could be up to hundreds of gallons a day per big old tree, cooling the atmosphere by taking the energy out, adding water to create rainfall in some other place. So it's the whole pump theory, you know, it's creating high pressure and low pressure that's circulating water across the globe. And it's not that well understood. It's a very exciting area of research.
You know, we've been throwing the term old growth forest around quite a bit. What is that?
An old growth forest, I think of it best as one that's never been cut. There are places on this planet where forests naturally grow, and if you leave them alone, they will eventually become what I'm calling an old growth forest. They will often have large trees in them, older trees in them, a lot of this coarse woody debris, because trees will have died at the end of their life. They will have standing dead trees. And they have a very complex structure because they have understory trees as well as overstory trees as well as dead trees. So that's kind of the easy answer to old growth forest definition. But it gets more complicated because you can have a forest like that that then is blown down in a tornado. So it's never been logged out, but it's been knocked down. But a lot of that biodiversity is still there. And a lot of structure is still there, so that forest will recover faster. And it's kind of like some people would call that an old growth forest and some people wouldn't. There isn't one exact definition for old growth forest. In fact, even the federal government's working on that right now. But anyway, the other part of the definition I wanted to share. So you can have that original forest that's just grown and never been cut as an old growth forest. But what if you have a forest that was cut 500 years ago and has not been cut since, and species have recovered and grown, and now it has, the salamanders have come back in because all the structure is there and the trees have gotten big and old? Well, I would call that an old growth forest also. And some would call that a secondary old growth forest. So you can have the untouched and you can have the one that has been cut but then recovered.
So I have always remembered something that I was interviewing Richard Manning, back in 1989, I think it was. And I threw out this line about, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to just take a forest that had been cut and then you preserve it? And then in what, 300 years, you'd have old growth forest. And he looked at me and said, Derek, those trees can live 1,000 years. And then after they fall, it can take hundreds of years for them to decompose in some cases. So in 500 years, you haven't even gone a third of the way through one carbon cycle. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I understand that old growth structure, but it just, and he wrote a book on prairies and how prairies actually can if you leave them alone, they can come back a lot faster than forests. But forests can take a little while to really take on these characteristics. Is this all mm-hmm. correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, that is so correct. But then, you know, so where do we draw the line? You know, there's some people that say, oh, if a forest has trees that are 150 years old, we'll call that an old growth forest. And that's nice if you want to protect that forest because it's one of the oldest we have, but it's certainly not quite functioning yet like a much older forest would, where those 150-year-old trees became 300 years old. I'm on the East Coast, so I'm talking East Coast ages, and then died and decomposed for another 150 years to get the full forest cycle. But I like what Mary Bird Davis did, the first survey of old growth forests on the East Coast. And this was in the 90s. We had no idea how much was left before she did this survey. And she says that we are between two forested worlds. There was our original forested world that we have now destroyed most of. But she said our new forested world, so the second old growth, if you will, is possible. So we're between the two. So none of those forests we cut have ever fully recovered yet. We're going to have to wait hundreds of more years. But it's so interesting because the human lifespan is not that long compared to most trees. So we are going to have to do this work of recovery over multiple generations. So we have to do our part now, but we also have to inspire the next generation and the next generation after that not to cut these places that we want to preserve. And I'm not saying not to cut anything. I'm just saying not to cut these places that we particularly want to see recover to become old growth again, because they can be lost in a moment, but it takes generations to save them.
So the land where I live was cut in the 70s. And I moved here in the late 90s, and one of the great joys of my life has been to watch the changes that have come for the last 24 years as more and more trees have died. And there was a lot of what they call dog hair originally. And almost every time that I walk through the forest after a big wind or rainstorm, I see yet another tree has fallen down somewhere, and it all makes me so happy to see. And again, this is nowhere. I mean, these are redwoods, and they're now 50 years old. So that would be the equivalent in, you know, how long they would live in their life. That's like a 4-year-old human or a 2-year-old human or something. But it still just brings me great joy to see the changes that come over the forest.
Mm-hmm. And it's so true. The forest will take care of itself, right? They've been doing this for hundreds of millions of years before there were humans even. And to think that we need to manage them so that it could become a healthy forest is ridiculous. The trees, the foresters will say, oh, we have to thin them because they're going to choke each other out. But as you can see with your own eyes, the forest will thin itself out. And those trees that are dying because they're thinning themselves out, those are the weaker trees. So what's left standing is the stronger trees. And then those trees, as they fall down, are food for a whole various food chain on the forest floor. So, and that carbon is feeding those standing living trees. So you've seen it with your own eyes. The forest will thin itself out. And then as that forest gets older and as those trees get larger and larger, now, sorry, you won't live to see this probably, but you'll have some gigantic trees. And then when one of those trees comes down naturally in a storm or for some other reason, it's going to fall over and create this big light gap. And those gaps are very important too, to let light loving organisms in, and including trees and wildflowers and some animal species. So, yeah, the forest knows how to manage itself for the maximum biodiversity.
So in a moment, I want to talk about how much old growth is left under whatever definition you want. But before then, can you talk a little bit? Something I notice here is how dramatically things change in different parts of the forest depending on how far they are from one of the meadows. And so what I'm really getting at is what they call the edge effect. Mm-hmm. And just I've noticed that there are changes in the in like the microfauna, the little tiny animals, even at a path, even when a path goes through the forest, there are if you go 40 feet from the path, the animals will be much different. Can you talk, and also just temperature, can you talk about the difference between inside of a forest and at the edge of a forest? Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about. So, yeah, inside the forest, so it's mostly about the shade that then also creates the humidity also. The evapotranspiration we're talking about creates humidity. So you have shade, you have humidity, and then you also have this rain of detritus coming down from the trees. You know, even the evergreen trees will shed needles, and they shed pollen, and they shed bark, and they shed all kinds of things. So you have this rain of detritus that's creating soil, and it's moist, and it's damp, and it's loose soil. And all of those niches are occupied. So that means the things adapted to live there are living there. Now, if you cut next to that forest, all of a sudden you have a hotter, drier area where the wind can get through, and you're going to have windblown seeds that then can enter the forest edges. So these days, that means a lot more invasive species near the edge. And there are then the inside forest species can't compete with these invasive species in a lot of cases. So there are also, in the east, we have cowbirds, and cowbirds are nest parasites. So they nest in the open area, but they will fly into a forest to kill the eggs of the forest birds in the nest and lay their own eggs in the nest instead. But the cowbirds can only go into the forest, I think it's like 50 meters, and then they'll want to come back out. So if you have a very large forest, those birds in the interior are not affected by the cowbirds. So those are just two examples of the edge effects.
Well, thank you for that. And actually, you said something else that reminds me of a different question I want to ask, which is, I live about, 2 miles from the coast. And so it's pretty windy here oftentimes. And this is another of the effects of the interior of a forest, that mm-hmm. I have stood in the forest when the tops are swaying like crazy, and there's 60 mile an hour wind up there, and down at the base of the trees, I literally feel not even a breeze. I feel nothing.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that cool? That is so cool.
And does that same thing happen on the East Coast?
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. And this is one of the challenges when, you know, a lot of the, I'm thinking of Maryland state government, New Jersey state government, these state forests, and they want to all of a sudden cut a chunk out of it. No, don't worry. It's okay. You know, we're leaving this forest next door. Well, that forest next door now becomes a lot more vulnerable to wind damage as well as the invasives I just mentioned. And then those trees fall down. It completely changes that ecosystem. And the wind is another reason why the intact old growth forests are a little more resistant to wildfires, because the wind doesn't go through and dry those forests out as easily. They stay moister, so they're less likely to catch fire. And of course, they can catch fire, we know, but as far as probability, they're less likely to.
I guess it's one more topic before we go to numbers of old growth or amount of old growth left, which is another problem with both logging and with the reduction of wildlife in forests is simply a loss of biomass. That, you know, when they log a forest, when you talked before about if there's a blowdown, there's still the structure. Mm-hmm. And not only is there the structure, but there's also those literally tons of carbon. Right. And if you log it, you've removed all that and it has to be built up again. And then also, I remember reading that I believe it's three times that forests in the Pacific Northwest evolved with salmon. And when the salmon are no longer present, the trees grow something like one third as fast as they are supposed to. Mm-hmm. Or you could say that the presence of salmon makes them grow three times faster, whichever way you want to put it. And I just think about, you know, the passenger pigeons or all the poop from the passenger pigeons, all the passenger pigeons themselves, all the wood bison, that there's this tremendous biomass has been just, and yes, they're individuals, but at the same time, there's just a tremendous chunk of carbon has been removed. Here's what I'm trying to say. I'll just say this and shut up. That it feels to me also like a lot of these forests are starving.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and it's because every time you harvest, every time you take out those trees, you're taking out that carbon and those micronutrients, and it's not being replaced. I mean, this is something you wrote about in your book, Strangely Like War, that really inspired me. You said nobody has ever shown that we can take three harvests out and that forest will ever recover. We don't have evidence for that. The foresters act like, oh, we can just keep cutting forever and it's sustainable. Well, it's not. Yes, the salmon were important for the forest because the bears would and other animals would drag the salmon that were spawning out of the streams in through the forest and then leave the carcass of the salmon. The carcass of the salmon is filled with nitrogen. It would decompose. It would feed the tree roots, among other nutrients. And so those trees were part of a cycle. Now you get rid of the salmon, and then you get rid of the big grandmother, grandfather trees, and you leave behind the youngsters, and they're struggling. Yeah, we've had so many deleterious effects, so many things that we've done already to our forests that for my mission, I'm just trying to save what we can and speak out and make sure some of these old forests remain.
Thank you for that. And sorry, one more topic just came up, which is a combination of David Ehrenfeld was not the first one to say this, but he's the one that I always think of because he said it to me, was not only is nature more complex than we think, but it's more complex than we're capable of thinking. Mm-hmm. And then add to that, I think it was Chris Mazur. And Chris Mazur was the one with the forest only lasts three rotations. Mm-hmm. But he also had this essay, which I'm sure you're aware of, where he talked about pooperoonies. Do you remember that?
Nah.
Oh, it was great. It was... Mm-hmm. It was an essay about the why Doug fir forests that were getting replanted were not taking hold the way they should in the Pacific Northwest. And it was because what they finally figured out is that red-backed voles eat a certain, voles are little creatures, and redback voles eat a certain mushroom, and then they poop. That's where we got the pooperoonies. They poop out, you know, I mean, they poop, and then their feces contain spores of that particular mushroom that then inoculates the roots of the Doug fir with a
mycorrhizae
that's necessary for the Doug firs to take up nutrients. And so I put those two together, that's one example of just only a three-part complexity, you know, three creature, fungus, vole, and Doug fir. And then it's just, there are all these connections that nature has evolved over hundreds of millions of years that we have absolutely no clue about why banana slugs, you know, might disappear if you do a certain thing.
Exactly right. And that's in my very first book I wrote called Teaching the Trees. That's what I'm talking about in that book, all these interrelationships of these different organisms, the even the plants that depend on other plants to live and grow. And the insects, like on the sycamore trees, there's 8 different insects that only live on sycamore tree leaves. So if you get rid of the sycamore trees and say, oh, you know, they're not valuable in the market, we're only going to plant Doug firs here now, then you've just eliminated all those species. And as far as the mycorrhizal network, we've only learned about that in the past few decades. I mean, that, and it's just now getting into common knowledge among the masses of people that I meet and the foresters. And if we're just now learning that, what else are we going to learn? Like you said, so many of these relationships. So we need to have some wild forests where the forest can just do what it wants to do, where we're not worried about controlling the spacing or certain diseases, where we just let it do and recover on its own. Even as you were talking about the carbon, that the biomass that's stored. So even the forests that have suffered from the wildfires, still a great deal of that carbon remains. And there's a lot of organisms that like that burned forest ecosystem. You know, right away, these borers come in, insect borers, and then the woodpeckers come in, and then they're all pooping, and then they're bringing in other things. So,
well, for crying out loud, they're black-backed woodpeckers. Why do you think they have black backs? Is right. So that they can fit in with a charred tree. I mean, they evolved. They evolved specifically to be camouflaged against a burned tree. It's just crazy.
Right, right. So we, you know, the forest industry says, oh, we have to salvage log, and they make it seem like it's for the health of the forest, but it's not. It's really for the marketplace. So we just need to be aware that so many of the excuses that they give for why a forest should be thinned or cleared, and they'll use excuses that it's for wildlife or the health of the forest. But no, it's almost always for the price that they're going to get in the market for that biomass.
So once again, before we get to the numbers on old growth, can you tell a couple more stories like the sycamore one? I love stories like that of interdependence between unexpected interdependence between species.
Okay, here's one. In the east here, we have American holly trees that are an understory tree, and they're evergreen. But the rest of our tall trees will lose their leaves here, most of them, like if we're in an oak hickory forest. So the oak hickory trees lose their leaves in the winter now, but the holly gets lots of light on a day like today, and they're photosynthesizing. But if you look closely at their leaves, you can sometimes see like a yellow labyrinth like track in the leaf. And what that is, there's a tiny larvae of a holly leaf miner. in there, it's living between the top layer and the bottom layer of the leaf. And that's its home. And it's just cruising through there, eating cells. And then there is another insect. Oh, by the way, that larvae was laid there by a little fly. That's all it does is look for holly trees. So if there's no holly trees, that fly is not going to be able to reproduce. So it's lucky it found a holly tree, laid its egg. The larvae is doing its thing in there. But then there's another insect that's a wasp that's the parasite to the holly leaf miner. So it's looking for those lines and it's looking for those little larvae, and it will stick its ovipositor through the leaf into the larvae. And now its eggs are going to take over and develop inside the larvae. And then eventually the parasite is going to emerge. So it goes on and on, but if there's no holly trees, there's no holly leaf miner, there's no wasp parasite, and then maybe no wood thrush bird that feeds on those parasites or flies. Who knows? That's a couple of them.
That's great. I love stories like that. So let's talk a little bit about how much old growth has been destroyed, and then from there, let's start to talk a little bit about the old growth forest network.
Okay, great. So what is left in the East? I take a deep breath because it hurts my heart to say this, but we have 1% left and in the East. And the largest extent of old growth is up in the Adirondacks of New York. There's some down in the Smoky Mountains. Some states like Connecticut, there's 0.06% left, you know, so just almost nothing. So it's like, can we preserve that what's left and then let some recover over multiple generations? In the West, there is 5% of old growth left. So when we talk about the old growth redwood forests, some people in the East think, oh, we saved them all. You know, they see these photos or they went to visit Muir Woods and they think that we saved them. No, 98% of the old growth redwood forests were cut. Only 2% of them remain. So 5%. And I think the reason there's more old growth in the West left is because the conservation movement finally caught on and saw what happened in the East by the time we were doing the serious cutting out West. And we saved a little bit more. So when I learned these figures, when I was working on my second book, Among the Ancients, where I visited one old growth forest in each of the eastern states, and I realized we can't lose any more of this. Can you imagine a world or country where, oh, 0%, it's all been cut, which could happen if we let it happen. So we need to preserve what's left. And I realized there was no organization that was specifically designed to do that, to speak for and to preserve these last old forests. And that just came to me, like, we need an organization to do this. We need to preserve the last of these forests. But then I took it a step further and said, and we need to let some recover. How are we going to do that? And the idea came to me, well, if we could do it county by county in the U.S., if we made sure that there was one forest at least in each county that would not be logged again and would be accessible and open to the public, then maybe we could build another generation of forest advocates and build this biodiversity back up to let these forests recover. So that whole vision of preserving what's left and letting some recover became what I called the Old Growth Forest Network. And when the network is completed, every county will have a place that we can go and see a forest that will never be cut. Every place that can support forest growth, you know, so not the deserts or the prairie counties, but most of the counties, 2/3 of the counties of the U.S. And it's a big job, but people have been getting on board. It has really created a spark in people that realize that we need to do this. We have had some very generous donors, both from individuals and family foundations. We don't get any government support at all. We've been able to increase our staff, which started out with just me as a part-time and then full-time as assistant. And now we have a small handful of people that I'm so pleased to be able to pay people to speak for the trees and try to preserve our old growth forests. So we're 185 forests into a mission that will be 2,300 forests when it's completed. But we've done what we've done in the first 10 years and we're gaining speed. So I'm very, very excited about it. It's something that's going to go on beyond my lifetime, I'm sure. But I think of it as our national parks. You know, they started with just an idea, and that's grown and grown and grown. And I think the Old Growth Forest Network will be the same way.
So these 185 forests, how many of those are already old growth, and how many of those have been saved to be one hopes mm-hmm. old growth in the future?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And what we do as we describe each of these forests on our website, so you can look by state, and then you can then within your state, you can look by county and you can see an exact description of the forest in your county if there is one. And if it is old growth, we say that right there. And if it's one that's second growth, been in recovery, we'll say that there. And I need to really do a count, but if I had to guess, I would guess that we're about at 50-50, I would say. And one of the reasons for that is because we're starting with some of the most obvious ones. So, you know, the bristlecone pines in California that have the oldest trees on the earth, that's in the Old Growth Forest Network. So as we continue to grow, we'll probably have changed that so it'll be more of the second growth that are in recovery, because there's not just that much old growth left.
So with the second growth ones, mm-hmm. You know, like I was saying earlier with the land here, when this is actually third growth here, how long is your oldest second growth? How long has it been protected, and have you seen changes as it changes? Have you seen changes in excuse me, the characteristics of the forest at all as it becomes a little bit older, is what I'm getting at.
Well, these have only been in for 10 years. So we're not going to see that many changes. And also, I'm not living next to all these forests like you are, you know, so you can really see the changes. And I'm sure that people that work in among these forests can see some changes. But what I see more is when I go to visit a 80-year-old forest and what that looks and feels like to me. And then I go to visit a 150-year-old forest and what that looks and feels like to me. And then when I visit a true old growth forest. So I've visited so many forests now of these different age categories that I can really sense how old they are just by walking into them. And sometimes I like to say, oh, I've seen more old growth forests than anybody in the country. And nobody's questioned me on that so far. So I have this kind of built-in intuition now about the forests. And one thing I've noticed that's interesting is that the older they get, the more beautiful they get in my eyes. So when I walk into a forest and I'm like, oh, this forest is just so beautiful, chances are that's going to be an old forest.
So this is completely unfair because it's such a broad question, but there are so many differences between different types of old growth forest. I mean, a bristlecone forest is not going to look the same as an old growth. Ponderosa pine forest is not going to look the same as there aren't many deciduous trees here in this mixed redwood, cedar, Doug fir forest, a few, but not many. So can you talk about some of the, just, I don't know, give an example or two of some very distinctive old growth forests that are just very different from each other.
Oh, wow. To me, yes, you're right. These forests are so different from each other, but it's kind of, if you compare it to humans, like you could compare a 100-year-old Indonesian person to a 100-year-old Swedish person, you know, and they would appear different from each other, like these two different forest types, yet you would be able to look at both of them and say, these are old people. You know, they've lived this long time and they become more and more unique over time. I think people do, and forests are the same way. They just, each tree even becomes more and more of an individual. So, like with your redwood trees there, your third growth redwood, a lot of these very young trees tend to look alike. Here it's loblolly pines, you know, they all kind of look alike. But when you walk into a 200-year-old forest, each of those trees that have lived that long, you could almost give them names. They're so much like individuals. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's how I look at the aging process. So you'd have individuals in a bristlecone pine forest that look very much individuals when they're old, and the same way in a Doug fir forest that's very old. Those trees would be individuals as well.
A couple questions left. One of them is, thank you for that. One of them is a line also from that interview I did of Dick Manning back in 1989 that has always stuck with me, is that whenever he enters an old growth forest, he was confronted with his own mortality because there is so much death in a forest. And one reason I love that is because just last night, and every day and every night, I take walks through this particular forest, and I see so many dead trees. I see trees who've been, like, there's a redwood right here that bears stripped they girdled it fairly high up. So the top of this particular redwood's now dead. And there are other trees that are fallen, and there is tremendous texture all through the forest. It's not just vertical, but there's, I would say, 1/10 of the trunks that I see in the forest are horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look more closely, I see spider webs all through this texture. Mm-hmm. And my point is that, just, do you want to comment on, and I don't mean this, you know, death like a scary thing, but it's just, there is, what I really want you to get at is just a brief statement about the importance of dead trees to a forest. That's what I'm trying to get at.
That's easy for me. You know, if you walk into a forest and you see, with a group of people, and you see a big tree that's fallen over and it's down on the ground, it's interesting because some of the people will say, oh, look at that. Isn't it a shame that tree died? And it'll make them kind of sad. And it makes me happy to see big dead trees in a forest. Because not only is that part of the natural cycle of the forest, those trees that died are going to be home for many other living things, from fungi to mosses to beetles to lizards, many other things, but they show that forest got left alone for long enough that tree got to be very large, and then it died of natural causes, if you will. So to me, that feels like the cycle of life was allowed to happen in the forest, and that's what I want to see happen in a forest. But if you walk into a forest and you don't see any big trees down, it means that forest is fairly young, and even if it has large standing trees, that's the first generation of large standing trees. And they may be just cut down if they're not allowed to fall down. So yeah, seeing that coarse woody debris makes me happy because that's what forests are supposed to do. And back to the human analogy, I know this is a really, really odd one, but if you could, you know, right away, we get rid of our dead. So we're burying them or we're cremating them. So we don't see a lot of dead humans around, but a lot of humans are dying. It's a natural part of the cycle of life, but we don't see it. So we're not used to it. But with the trees, they're not being buried or cremated. So there they are, just there for all of us to see and to let them continue their important role in the forest ecology.
And can you say one more? Thank you for that. That's great. And can you say one more thing about dead trees? And that's dead standing trees and their importance to insects and birds.
So dead standing trees also make me happy. We call them snags. And they also show that nobody came in and harvested that forest and managed that forest. Because usually if they're managing a forest, they'll just knock over the snags because they want to get the dead trees down to make room for the young living trees. So seeing snags, it's like, oh boy, nobody's been in here messing with this forest. So a tree dies, but it's still standing, and it'll usually be rotting from the inside from a fungus that can only live in the dead wood. And because it's rotting on the inside, it's hollow, and then a branch will fall off, and then there'll be a cavity. And that cavity is so important for many type of mammals, like you mentioned, red-backed voles, but also flying squirrels. Here in the East, raccoons could live there. And many birds, you know, woodpeckers can cut their own holes, but there's a lot of forest-dwelling birds that are live in cavities that don't have beaks that can make their own holes. So they depend on finding cavities, such as bluebirds here in the East. And I could name the, I'm sure listeners can name the ones out West. So without standing dead trees, you're not going to have these apartment buildings, if you will, for all these other organisms to live in. And these cavities are important because they're high above the forest floor. So organisms that are looking to predate nests can't get to them because they're way up high in these cavities. So the snags, standing snags, very important.
So two questions left and then we're done. One question is there anything you wanted me to ask that you haven't had the chance to say now?
I think it's a very exciting time for forests and old growth forests because our federal government is actually talking about this. You know, you asked me the definition of old growth, and it's funny because Biden made an executive order where he asked the government to come up with a definition for old growth and then to decide where it's located and how much of it is left. And that's our first step in protecting it. And so it was really interesting. All of a sudden, all these, you know, the Department of Forestry, Department of Agriculture, BLM, they're all trying to come up with a definition. And I'm sitting in on these Zoom meetings, and then they're trying to figure out how much is left. Can you imagine? We've never inventoried the old growth on the federal lands. And so this is all happening right now. And people are working hard in our federal government to try to figure this out because there was an executive order. And then on Earth Day, so in April, the month my book comes out, Biden is going to then report on what they came up with. So it's a really exciting, interesting time for our federal government to finally be talking about old growth and what we can do to protect it on the federal lands.
Well, thank you for that. And the last question is, how can people, if they want to either support or help the Old Growth Forest Network, what can they do?
The best way is to start with our website, oldgrowthforest.net, .net for the network. And then there's so many things you can do from there. One, you can just get on our list and we don't hound people. And that way, if I come and dedicate a forest in your area, we'll let you know and invite you there. You can also nominate a forest if you know, oh, there's this amazing old growth forest, you should know about this. Another thing you can do there is this is such a big project. You know, there's so many counties, so we need a volunteer in each county to help us decide what is the best forest in that county that then we could help protect. We call those county coordinators. So you can look on the website and see if there's someone in your county or not. It's a fun job. Get to hike around, look at the other forests. You can also donate monetarily. There's a donate button on there. We really appreciate it. That helps us do our work. And I would also just raise, that's how you can connect with the Old Growth Forest Network and what you can do for us. But just in general, speaking out for the trees, realizing what are the forests in your community? Are they protected? How you can help to see them be protected if they're not. That's what it's going to take. A lot of people all over the country that are doing this wherever they live. Think globally, act locally, right? Creating a community of people who care about our forests.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for all of the work that you've done over the years. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Joan Maloof. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.